Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a program of table talk about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm delighted to have on the program today Anne Gaud Tinker. Anne is a Vassar alumna, and she also has graduate degrees from Georgetown and Johns Hopkins universities. She is co-author of a monograph on the South Carolina painter Alice Ravenel Hughey Smith that we're going to be discussing on the show today. Alice Smith was born in 1876 and died in 1958. Alice also happens to be Anne's great aunt, so she'll be talking about family here. The book was published in 2021 by Evening Post Books and is entitled Alice Ravenel Hughey Smith, Charleston Renaissance Artist. The other authors of the book are Dwight McInvale, who is director of the Georgetown County Library, and Caroline Palmer, who is an art historian and also a relation of the artist. So, welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on the show. I'm really pleased. So, great book, too. I really enjoyed reading it. So, before we dive into the book, I thought maybe you could talk a bit about your time here at Vassar, which is something I try to do when I have alums on the show, only because you can give a picture of what the place was like when you were here. And it also tells us something about ourselves as a matter of cultivating our own history. So, I suppose the question is, what brought you to Vassar originally, and what did you study while you were here? I don't know if you have any thoughts. Sometimes people don't always have happy memories of a place, but.
Well, I remember I have a couple of grandsons who were applying, one to high school and one to college. And it's a whole different ball game now because basically what I did was I applied to where my mother went, which was Bryn Mawr, and where my aunt went, which was Vassar. And I went to look at them and I decided that there were people who looked happier at Vassar. So I ended up at Vassar. But I graduated in 1967, and actually last June, I was at one of my reunions there, and I really enjoyed being back. My majors were political science and Spanish, and I'd had French during high school, so I had a pretty good foundation of two languages. And then one of the highlights of my Vassar experience was to be in Madrid on my spring year abroad, half year abroad, where I went to the University of Madrid and I took a course at the Prado Museum and I lived with a family on a fourth floor walk up and they didn't speak any English. So it was very good for my Spanish.
Had you taken Art 105 or any art courses at all before this?
No,
No.
no.
Okay, so this
And
was your
so
introduction to the art
I
world.
took music and art in Spanish, which was quite a challenge, really. Amazing that I didn't fail the two courses, but I learned a lot and it was really quite a treat. But when I was at Vassar, it wasn't co-ed, so it was just women. So
That
I
was
spent
just
quite a few
before.
weekends visiting my aunt and uncle in New York and going to boys' colleges. There really wasn't a lot going on in terms of social life then.
On campus,
And the mid-60s were really a difficult time. I mean, you had the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, and several of my friends had to go off to Vietnam, and I was caught up in the civil rights movement. So it was quite a tumultuous period, I think, the 60s.
Interesting time to be in college, though. I
It
was
was.
I caught the tail end of that, so.
Yes, I had been to boarding school for 3 years before Vassar. I was at Concord Academy in Concord, Massachusetts. And I have to say, I loved that. It was my first time to be away from home and on my own and making new friends. I found it harder to feel happy at Vassar. Part of it, I think, was Poughkeepsie at that point was not a really great place to be. I mean, you were sort of in this island at Vassar. And then all those things that were going on. But studying Spanish at Vassar really had a very significant impact on shaping my career because I went on to receive a master's degree at Georgetown University in Latin American Studies. And then I ended up working at the US Foreign Assistance Program, focusing on women's health and family planning in several Latin American countries. So I traveled quite often. during that time.
Really interesting. I was just talking to another alum who would have been class of 1957. She went on to do really cutting edge work in family planning in Switzerland. She married a Swiss man and never came back, but same kind of work, I think. Vassar was turning out people who did make a contribution. So you went into public medicine then?
So actually public health. So a few years after I started my career, I was awarded a fellowship to Johns Hopkins University and received a master's degree in public health and international public health principally. And at that point, I moved to the World Bank in Washington, which is part of the UN system.
Yeah.
And I led their Safe Motherhood Initiative, which was a wonderful opportunity. I became a lead health specialist in the policy department and then joined the Asia regional program, focusing on improving women's health and maternal health and women's health and also child health to some extent. So then after 10 years there, I took a position at Save the Children and headed up a new program funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for maternal and newborn health. And that became Save the Children's largest international program during my years there from 2000 to 2010.
Ah, you've been busy in recent years, yes. But you're retired now, is that true?
So I retired in 2010.
Oh, you did, okay.
And my husband and I moved to Charleston, South Carolina, where we continue to live.
Yeah.
We spend our summers up in Massachusetts at a family home. We have a lot of family who live in the north. So we spend summers in the north with the family. And then we have a daughter who's four blocks away with two grandchildren here in Charleston. So we have a lot of time with children and grandchildren, and we do some traveling. We're involved in several organizations here. I'm on the board of the Gibbs Museum of Art. I'm a trustee at the Middleton Place Foundation, and then on the board of the Historic Charleston Foundation. So very much involved
in the arts there.
In the arts and in the history of Charleston, which is where my ancestors were from.
Yeah, you have two streams influencing you then, your interest in art that you would have gained in Spain, but also your family history then, yes, because... So
unfortunately, I am not an artist. I did not inherit her genes, but my daughter Caroline, who is a co-author, is really a wonderful artist. And so I'm glad that she at least received the gift.
I didn't realize Caroline was an artist then. And your daughter, I didn't realize she was your daughter. I knew
she's
she
my
was
daughter.
An art
she
historian.
Went to Duke University and majored in art, history of art. And then she worked at MoMA in New York and has had various jobs that weren't art related, but now she's back to doing painting and drawing. So I think that makes her very happy to do that.
So you're on the board of Middleton Place, and that was one of Alice's favorite places, if not her home. Wasn't it an ancestral home anyway?
Right. Yes. Yeah, we are all Middletons. So my ancestor, as is true of her, was Arthur Middleton, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And he was the man who started Middleton Place. And I also, and Alice has, we have Huguenot heritage, because as you mentioned, Alice's middle names are Ravenel and Huguet. So the Ravenels and the Huguets fled from religious persecution in France to England and then to Charleston, whereas my English ancestors came pretty much straight to Charleston. But yes, I spent a lot of time with her at Middleton Place, which was one of my favorite places as well as hers. And when she was growing up, she used to walk there with her father, 15 miles
15
there.
15 miles, yes.
And
I read that. Yes.
Miles back.
So she had no trouble when she found herself living in New York, walking across Central Park to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Right. Yes. That's right, exactly.
Funny. So Alice is known especially as a kind of landscape artist, isn't she? And a painter of flora and fauna, but she has other artistic skills. She's also an illustrator. So can you just give us an overview of Alice and her role in the world as an artist?
Well, you know, I hadn't realized really until we did this book the breadth and extent of her work. I knew her for 11 years before she died when I was a child. We used to come down here every 2 weeks in the spring and stay with her and my other relatives at 69 Church Street in Charleston, where she lived and died. But she started painting miniature and full-sized portraits and taught art classes, and this helped create some income as well as broadened her reputation as an artist. She then went on to create woodblock prints and oil paintings on mahogany, which I have some of, watercolor landscapes, precise sketches, and architectural drawings. So she was really quite versatile. And she also wrote poetry as well as articles and books. She is best known, as you said, for her luminous landscapes, but she was also an illustrator, which began when she illustrated a seminal study of historic Charleston written together with her father in 1917. And she created illustrations for several other books during her artistic career.
Is it Dwellings of Charleston, I think it's
Yes,
called?
exactly. Yes.
Famous work in historical preservation, actually, that is kind of a prototype for other books in other cities.
Yes, she detailed the architectural drawings of the main historic houses on Charleston's peninsula, which inspired the historic movement in Charleston. And what now is a regulatory system called the BAR, or Board of Architectural Review, which still exists today to protect old buildings from demolition. And those old buildings now not only include some of the European, but also some of the Black-owned buildings in Charleston. And it's been quite important to our history and tourism to tell a balanced story of Charleston.
Wonderful part of the book, actually, her studies of African Americans throughout the book. I found we have here in the Vassar Art Library one of the books Alice illustrated early in this period, Elizabeth Waite's Alston Pringle's book based on her diaries called A Woman Rice Planter, which has an introduction by Owen Winter, which Alston published under the pseudonym Patience Pennington, and it has a beautiful publisher's binding based on one of Alice's illustrations. And it's really just a masterful work of illustration. The whole book has beautiful illustrations in it.
Well,
Some of my
she was the illustrator of that. And it's very interesting because if you've heard of Owen Wister had a place in Charleston, and he and Alice became friends. And she wasn't going to do the illustrations for that book, but he encouraged her to do it. And it was one of her first illustrating attempts, and it became very well known at the time and helped her launch her career. So somebody like Owen Wister was another person in her life who was supportive. And you know, I have to really emphasize that she was not like most of the women of her time. I mean, she was really independent and self-reliant and a businesswoman in a time when most of her peers were serving tea.
You mentioned the mahogany paintings. Some of the works in the book that are discussed and illuminated there are actually in your own collection then? I mean, these are familiar, some of them, I
Yes,
suppose.
in fact, I mean, I grew up with her paintings on the walls of our house when I was a child too. But I have several, and my daughter and other members of our family have quite a few. And one of the real advantages of having this book is that it contains illustrations that have never been seen by the public because they are privately owned
Private,
by family and friends. I have the only self-portrait that she did at the age of 32. And it's sort of an interesting story. Somebody told me that it was going to be auctioned at a auction house, and I just didn't see how that could go out of the family. So I went up to this big auction house, and first time I'd ever bid on anything at a formal auction, but I ended up bringing it home, and
Oh,
it's now in my
wonderful.
dining room. So but I did
Wonderful.
inherit quite a few of her paintings as well.
And then, do you have memories of her then as a child?
Well, yeah, we'd sit on the piazza together. We have what's called a piazza here in Charleston. The old houses have porches that face the way the breeze is coming.
Uh-huh.
Because, of course, they didn't have air conditioning. So
Yeah.
that was the place that everybody spent their time in the summer. And we used to go on family picnics together. She loved that. And we spent quite a bit of time at Middleton Place
Uh-huh. She seems, from
gardening.
all accounts, to have been a very charismatic person. A little quirky for sure, but because of that, very charismatic, I think. And she seems to have loved children too. It's the impression I get, from
She did. She did. She was
Painting of
very
Josephine.
different from many of the white women of her time, were serving tea and bringing up children and talking about their fashions. And she was very different. I mean, she was intrepid. She ventured into forests and swamps and knew what to do if she got a snake bite. And she was a professional. She had a professional career. She had a lot of friends. She was a great mentor to many other women artists. She helped start the Southern Arts League down here, which was mainly women artists who would meet once a year. And it turned out that there were 1,000 members while she was involved. So she was a mentor to others. She was also mentored by a couple of important people in her lifetime.
So how did the book come about? The book seems to owe a lot to Dwight MacInvale, yes?
Yes. Yes. The book was really inspired by Dwight MacInvale, whose parents were close friends of Alice's. And he knew her the way I did when he was a small child and sort of considered her kind of a grandmother. And Dwight's father met Alice when he was in the Navy in Charleston. And at that time, this is during the World War, Charleston houses were likely to be opened to people who didn't have other places to stay. So he stayed with them for a while and they got to be good friends. And then when Dwight's father married, Alice took his wife under her wing and taught her art. And then when she had three children and her husband became ill, she was very concerned about Dwight and his siblings and whether they'd be able to go to college. So Alice left most of her estate to this family so that the three children could go to college. So I think that was part of why Dwight really wanted to write this book, as to honor her.
Tells you a lot about who she was also, that she would do
Yes,
that.
exactly. And so after he completed a lot of research, he asked my daughter and me to join him to take the book to publication, to help edit it, to help provide the family perspective, and to basically, it had started out, it probably would have been 1,000 pages if we hadn't been involved. And I don't think it would have been, he had a couple of attempts to publish it at publishing houses, and they said no.
They always want to
So
cut.
Caroline and I did a lot of editing and bringing a family perspective into that. But we are very proud that this spring we were awarded the Benjamin Franklin Award for the category of art and photography. So this was a very prestigious award that we were happy to receive. It was very educational and thought-provoking to write a book about a historical figure like Alice, who was born a decade after the Civil War. She was raised by once wealthy rice planters, and she had a selective historical memory of the past, as did her parents,
Oh,
of course, her family.
It's interesting to delve into your own history in this way, in that your own history is history in a sense. I mean, your own family history. It will extend out into the world and teach you about the world if you research your own family, I found. That's the beauty of genealogy. It's not making some claim that you're descended from Charlemagne, as everybody is when everything gets mixed up right away, But it's tracing the historical influences in your family over time.
And also realizing that, you're getting one perspective. You're getting the perspective of a person at a period of time. And, what we've learned so much since then is that the story of the African American participants in, I mean, they were really what made the South as prosperous it was.
Yes, yeah.
We're now realizing they deserve considerable
Part of the, yeah, the credit, yes, the history,
recognition and credit for the hard work that they did unjustly. It's an interesting period of time.
The thing about Alice is, as she looks back, she is really interested in place. I mean, and she absorbs it, it seems, and then reflects it back in her paintings. Reminds me in some ways of Georgia O'Keeffe when she went out west. She almost becomes the landscape. She's very much like this for South Carolina. I mean, for the landscape around Charleston, the low country, especially the swamp area, the rice plantations, the flora and fauna, everything she paints, she really captures it in a wonderful way. And almost as a kind of preservationist. I mean, she's interested, as you mentioned, in architectural preservation and the preservation of the town, but she's also interested in the preservation of the natural environment, isn't she?
Absolutely. Yes, she created a book for her two nieces, one of whom was my mother, which was about protecting herons and egrets and other low country wildlife to save a heron's nesting island from development. So she was involved in preserving the natural environment. And, I think that she really saw the land as something constant and healing. And I kind of feel the same when I go to Middleton Place reunions every 5 years. And for the last 20 years, they have been mixed reunions with the African American as well as the European descendants. And, we all have this common thread, very different experiences, obviously, but that land has brought us together and we're walking where our ancestors did. And we've made a lot of friends that way. We've found a lot of commonalities, and it's been a really wonderful way to celebrate the change of time, but also to sort of acknowledge where we came from.
Absolutely fascinating. That's the thing that really strikes me about the whole book is that it has a kind of healing feeling about it. I think of Kandinsky's Spiritual in the Work of Art, and I think of Alice as a spiritual artist here. It comes through the painting for sure. I don't know if she was that way in person, but I have a feeling her life and her painting are very, very much totally entwined. The way she's entwined into the landscape there, and the people in the landscape, all the people in the landscape. So.
Yeah, I know. Her last painting was titled Final Flight, and it shows a large white heron flying away from a stormy sea to soar above the shore towards the sky. And it really represents her going to rest because the next year she died from a heart attack. And the epitaph at her grave is a verse by the English poet Walter Savage Landor, which reads, "Nature I loved, and next to nature, art." So she really was at one with the natural environment.
So she was a bit of an archivist herself. I mean, there's a lot of research I can see that goes into this book, but she ordered and collected things in some of her projects, certainly the book that she did with her father on Charleston dwelling places, but in other ways also, didn't she? She was a collector for sure. And she seems to have been an organizer also, a cataloger.
Yeah, I think so. We've found a lot of her materials at the Gibbs Museum of Art, which is where she donated at her death many of her paintings and her sketchbooks and her other materials. And she was really very detailed and very thorough. I mean, you'll see in her sketchbooks, she not only did a sketch, but she would also describe the nuance of color in a flower. And of course, when she took a photograph, they didn't have color photographs. They just had black and white photographs. So she would again annotate, these photographs with enormous detail about what she was seeing. And she did the same with the architectural drawings with that kind of precision.
Yeah, there's something about the works. I'm around art all the time, so I tend to forget exactly what's happening when I look at a work. But when I look at her paintings, if you really look at them, you can see how she renders things that are we don't think about often. Just really wonderfully. I suppose if you're in the landscape, you'd notice it possibly if you went then over to the Gibbs Museum or Middleton Place and then looked at the paintings. But she can actually render the humidity and the effect of humidity on light in
That's
an
true.
interesting way.
I know there's one wonderful painting of the Great Blake Reserve, which is, this beautiful swamp area in the low country. And you have to look very, very carefully, but if you look at the swamp, you can see the outline of an alligator, but you have to
You have
look
to
really
look.
carefully.
There's another painting with a deer in it that you'd never notice the deer unless, unless you look really hard. Then it just
Yes.
dawns on you. There's just a stag's head looking back at you from the trees there.
Right. I have a quote. I was wondering if I could read
Oh,
some.
yes. Oh, yeah, sure. It's lovely to have people read from the book
Okay,
door.
so here, this is what she wrote in her, one of the things she wrote in her memoirs, and we were very fortunate to have her memoirs. That was really, really helpful. So she wrote, "I think I must be a throwback to a pioneer forefather. I feel at home sitting in a wet and muddy boat, scrambling up on banks and hummocks to lighten the boat, soaking wet with the dew and then scorching in the sun, looking at the raised head of an alligator swimming and carrying his tail above the water, or a deer peeping through the grasses and palmettos, or listening to the marsh birds' plaintive calling and splashing."
Yeah,
So
really
she
wonderful.
really
She
was
captures
an
it.
observer.
Yeah, and she writes really, really well
She
too. She
does. She
does, doesn't
does.
she? Yeah,
And
very cool.
here's a woman who she went to a girls' school in Charleston. Her parents, her family couldn't afford to send her to college. So she took art classes, but somehow she learned how to write beautifully and write poetry, write books, write descriptions of what she was seeing. So it's amazing how one can be self-taught in those days and have so
Yes,
much.
yeah. Although she isn't really what you'd call an outsider artist, you could see she's trained. I mean, she's trained at least in looking at other people's things. So she did have some training with the Carolina Art Association right in Charleston when she was young.
She did, yes. In fact, the decision for her to be an artist came very early. She was born, as I mentioned, a decade after the Civil War, and money was short. Charleston was dilapidated. So at the age of 10, her grandmother told her she would need to earn a living and that she was to be an artist. Her sister Caroline was told that she would be a piano teacher. And so that's what happened.
Her father was supportive also of this,
Yes,
wasn't
he
he?
was very supportive. Her mother died when she was 11 from severe anemia. So she was really brought up by her grandmother and her father and her nanny, whose name was Da, which means caregiver in Gullah.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, okay. And Gullah is that sort of Creole language that the African Americans in the area in South Carolina speak.
Exactly, exactly.
So
Yeah.
it's a whole culture, not just a language.
Right. But she didn't have any connection to Vassar, but
No,
she
she.
did. When she was 61, Mount Holyoke College awarded her an honorary Doctor of Letters degree at their 100th anniversary celebration. And so she wrote in her memoirs how amazing it felt to be, she'd only attended high school, and here she was, amidst college graduates and distinguished professors. So that was quite an honor, and we couldn't really figure out how that happened. How did she get connected to Mount Holyoke? I do not know.
Wonderful place it is. Founded by Mary Lyon, who was one of the founders of female education, sort of generally across the Northeast. She's the person who built the model of all the female seminaries that Vassar derives from, also. So, but wonderful place, Mount Holyoke, wonderful tradition. I think Mary Lyon is buried right on the campus there.
Oh,
So,
really?
And key to her idea of education, especially for Mount Holyoke, was she wanted ordinary people without money to be able to attend. It didn't matter whether you were wealthy or not. She wanted women, to be able to attend from all walks of life.
Well, I think this, when Alice was given this Doctor of Letters, it was an opportunity for the head of Mount Holyoke to recognize some women in the national sphere who deserved attention. So they were very supportive of women's careers and opportunities.
So she studied at the Carolina Art Association, and then she also studied miniature painting in New York. And I think she has an ancestor. You have an ancestor who was a miniature painter. Yes, is it Charles Fraser? Yeah.
Charles Fraser, yeah. She had a French teacher who taught her the fundamentals of painting and drawing at the Carolina Art Association, which she attended for 2 years after high school. But then she did have an opportunity to be in New York, where her brother lived. And she learned miniature painting, portrait painting, which is ivory on ivory. And it was before people had photographs. So they would
iPhones,
have a miniature painting of a relative or a loved one that they would have as a brooch or in their bedroom or whatever. So she did learn miniature painting. And she also wrote a book about her ancestor, Charles Fraser.
She also then has other artists mentored her. One is Burge Harrison, the Woodstock tonalist. Great artist, I think, you know, overlooked. He, you know, he's local here. We know him as a Woodstock artist, but he was a national artist when he took an interest in her. Yes. And,
and well, then he used to come down to Charleston. And at first, you know, she tried to approach him and say, I'd really like to learn from you. And he sort of said, well, you know, I don't have time. So she just kind of hung around and she offered to help him mail things. And so somehow this relationship developed and he began to really teach her the tonalist approach of light and the mood and shadow and so forth. But then she was also very influenced by her distant cousin, Mott Alston Reed.
Yeah, she had a kind of crush on him, did she not? I mean, it seems like there was a love interest there anyway.
It was, we learned, really, that Alice and Mott Alston Reed had been in love, and they would have gotten married, but he was very ill and died in his 40s. But he inspired her to learn about Japanese art. He had an incredible collection of Hiroshige's and hokusais and whatnot.
And when I was thinking of her as a cataloger, that's what I was thinking of. She helped him catalog his collection.
She did.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, she did. You're absolutely right. Yeah. When he died, she actually did catalog all of his Japanese prints.
Yeah.
I have two of them actually.
Oh, do you? Yeah. And you can see it's a tremendous influence on her work if you look at her style over time.
Very much so.
Yeah. And then, well, she does Japanese prints herself. She learns printing, doesn't she?
Yes.
And they're beautiful things. I mean, they look like Japanese prints to anybody just looking at them. Woodblock, yes, woodblock. Not an easy technique to master.
I mean, it's one thing to become a
watercolor, you know, is a difficult medium in and of itself, and then to go on to prints. So she isn't averse to tackling, you know, a difficult technique by any means.
In fact, she even started the Charleston Etchers Club.
Oh, did she?
of like-minded artists who learned how to do these woodblock prints. Because they found they, unlike a painting that is by itself, they could make several prints and sell them.
There was a real need to be able to sell one's art at this time if you want to be any kind of artist at all. So then she forms a kind of, I would almost call it a colony in the Pink House on Chalmers Street, I think, after the war, where she's a sort of principal. It's a gallery, and at the same time, it's her studio. But she does help then other artists sell their work there, and she makes the house into a gallery. So she's able to help people, other artists, market their art and market her own art through this also, from what I can gather from the book. And then, of course, you know, there are other people here. I'm thinking of the McInvales. You know, she supports them here, the naval officer that is the father, one of the authors of the book, Dwight. But also Alice's sister sets up camp here as a piano teacher, and another relation, Herbert Ravenel Sass, a writer. So it's a whole colony, sort of artist colony, that she has going here. And it's a colony that does depend to some extent on their being able to sell works of art, you know, out of the home, right? And it's a beautiful looking little spot. I did look it up on Google Street Maps, you know, the Pink House.
Yes, Atlantic Street.
There are a lot of pink houses in Charleston, aren't there? I wonder what that's all about. I mean,
the Pink House was her second studio. The studio, the art colony, was really around Atlantic Street, and she had She was at eight, I think it was either 8 or 10 Atlantic Street, and several of the other artists were in that area. And they'd be open for, you could come for tea and see the artwork of the various artists, mostly women who had studios there. But then after that, she and Dwight's father, started a studio called the Pink House, which is one of the oldest buildings in Charleston on Chalmers Street. And I think it was pink because it had sort of the Caribbean look. There was a lot of influence on Charleston from the Caribbean, which is where a lot of the rice planters had come to have sugar plantations before they came to Charleston. So there was quite a bit of Caribbean influence.
You mentioned, interestingly, in the book, someone mentions that rice planting is a chief industry of that part of South Carolina and indigo, but rice planting especially. And the technology for it comes from the slaves themselves, from African Americans bringing it over from Africa. It's something they should take credit for, you know? So,
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Yes, Alice did the paintings for a book called The Carolina Rice Plantations of the 1850s, which was based on her father's recollections, as well as some firsthand knowledge about rice production that continued after the Civil War. But really, rice was not profitable after the 1920s, really. But yes, her paintings provide a very detailed and sort of unique technical record of the process of low country rice production and illustrates the skills and hard labor of the workers who built the rice fields, who were really responsible for the prosperity and influence that the South came to have in the 17 and 1800s. But, as has been acknowledged, her paintings did not record the cruel and unjust nature of enslavement.
Slavery,
Well,
no, yeah,
like other Renaissance artists, she painted the beauty she saw in nature rather than the ugliness and injustice, but that did exist and is certainly part of the full story of the past. But their effort was to bring an economic recovery to Charleston. And so bringing an economic recovery was much more successful when you painted beautiful landscapes of the Low Country. So anyway, they had an enormous influence on the development of Charleston as a tourist industry.
Yeah, a lot of people would come down to Charleston to buy art for this very reason, didn't they? So I guess I wanted to point out with this studio and with the people she was associating with, this seems to have been a wonderful period in her life. She seems to have done a lot of people a lot of good, in a sense, helped them in many ways. But she really seems to blossom herself in this period, both artistically and just as a person. And a lot of this has to do with friendships, doesn't it? I mean, she's able to form these kind of deep friendships with people that aren't just social relations. I mean, they seem to have a kind of spiritual component. This is the impression I get from the book, anyway, that, she finds kindred spirits, I suppose you'd have to say, and then she really forms attachments.
Well, I think that she felt that she and her colleagues could be part of a future because so much of the generation before was stuck in wishing that things were the way they had been. And she and her colleagues were intent on a new Charleston.
Well, it seems to be coming to pass, doesn't it?
And I think it's also become much more, there's a recognition here that the African American contribution is very important to acknowledge. And so in January of next year, we are opening a fabulous International African American Museum here in Charleston.
Oh, wonderful. That is wonderful. Really wonderful. Yeah, that seems to be part of the spirituality here that's being infused by her. That's part, when I mentioned Kandinsky and her painting there, it seems to be in tune with this in a great way. And especially in those paintings of African American laborers on their own farms or on commercial farms later, long after slavery's over. But that interest in the technology of planting itself and the beauty of that.
And the skill.
And the skill that goes into it, sure. So just to sort of give an impression, my own impression of the book here is that Alice seems to me in her art to be a spiritual person, And I would guess that her art and life are kind of commingled in this. And she seems to absorb and then radiate back the beauty of the world, and especially the natural world, with sort of tranquility that you feel. And, you know, there is a kind of healing in this, I think, in the way landscapes especially can heal, in that they exist across time. They're sort of timeless spaces. And she really pulls you into this world of landscape. And maybe heal the traumas of dark moments in time, you know, Civil War being, as Americans collectively, our real trauma that we don't seem to have got entirely past by any means. But maybe there's something key here in these paintings and in Alice's vision itself, and that the landscape is the thing that we can kind of rally around and then build a future on, a spiritual future.
Yeah.
And there's work to be done there also in preservation and conservation. And then urban conservation, I imagine, is sort of part of this too. So, and then that makes Alice's depictions here of African-American life and Black labor before and after the Civil War important, I think, and interesting. I'd say these depictions aren't really exploitive so much as they are therapeutic. And I wonder if that would make sense to Alice.
I think that's a good point. Certainly, she wanted to honor the contribution they made and to be, I mean, if you're an engineer, you will look at her depictions of the rice cultivation process and really see all the nuances and the skill that it took to till this crazy swampland and then to build the canals and navigate the alligators. I mean, it was no small task.
No.
And we have an ambassador for art here in South Carolina whose name is Jonathan Green. He's a Black artist here and is very talented. And he's a great admirer of Alice's because he feels that there's really no other testament to the detailed process that the Africans brought from West Africa to the Low Country to provide the rice production that went on here for 200 years.
We have an exhibit of artist books in my art library now called Memory and Oblivion. And the message of the exhibit, I would say if it has a message, is that it has to do with all kinds of trauma, especially, and the way we respond to trauma, including the Holocaust and racism and you know, a whole slew of traumatic situations in the human condition. And it seems over time, people come to the realization that you can't get past trauma if you blind yourself to it. But what you have to do is consider it in the present in an embodied way and reformulate it in such a way that you can use the present and your present experience in a way to come to terms with what the past has been without developing an amnesia about it. And that seems to apply here with her when I look at her work. It's about embodying the past in the present and the beauty of the present by seeing it clearly, I guess you could have to say so.
Well, she certainly, her paintings certainly communicate her passion for the land.
Yeah.
The herons and the egrets and that call it home.
Yeah. And in the end, she was a bird painter, especially, wasn't she?
She
just loved birds. Yeah.
I think that in many of her paintings, the herons actually represented her.
Oh,
like the one that she did. Yeah. In her last year of painting.
In her children's book, which I think is called The Heron, that's been reprinted, hasn't it?
The Heron book, yes. That was the book that was written for my mother and her siblings. And it's all about protecting the wildlife from development. And
yeah, hopefully it's available on Amazon, I would hope so.
Yes, I hope so. Yeah, it used to be.
To go
I don't
back
know
and look, yeah.
But The Heron, it's called The Heron Book. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's her poetry and her illustrations of all the different categories of herons and sort of what their life is like. And it's really quite delightful as a child's story.
Yeah, we have them here, and I'm always just struck. Blue herons, especially, they come
Oh,
up
do
and down
you?
the Hudson, yeah, and right on Vassar Lake and Sunset Lake. There are a couple that live there, and there I think there are a couple live on Vassar Lake right across the road here. And there's just something just about them, you know. You'd think they would be kind of awkward, ungainly birds, the way they're shaped, but they're just
Yeah.
so beautiful when they
They're very
fly, when they
majestic.
stand there. They are, yeah, they are. I can see why the Japanese were taken with them. So,
Yes,
yeah.
that's true. Yes, indeed.
So I'd like to thank you, Anne, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about the book Alice Ravenel, Eugene Smith, a Charleston Renaissance artist. It's been wonderful and really inspiring, actually. It's an inspiring book, I have to say. It's not just a book of pictures. Beautifully illustrated. I don't think I mentioned that. The illustrations are just wonderful. It's wonderfully produced.
Well, there are 200 illustrations, and they were all based on very professionally taken photographs of her work.
Yeah, Thames and Hudson couldn't have done it better. You know, it's really a beautiful work. So.
Thank you so much for your interest.